from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last week, a recording was released by the website Mormon Leaks. In it, a woman confronted Joseph Bishop. He was the president of the Mormon Mission Training Center in Provo in the 1980s. She said Bishop had raped her in a room in the training center basement in 1984. She was a missionary at the time. In the recording, she said she wanted to confront him and get from him a confession and an apology. Now, this recording has raised larger questions about how Mormon leaders are responding to allegations of abuse and whether they're helping victims or just protecting the reputation of the church. So today in the program, we're going to be talking about the questions raised in this tape, and we're inviting you to join us with your own questions, your own reaction. After the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. By now, a lot of you have heard the recording. It was a nearly three-hour conversation between a woman not identified and Joseph Bishop, a man who had served in various high-ranking positions in the LDS Church. He was president of the church's missionary training center in Provo in the 1980s. Last week, the recording was released by the website Mormon Leaks. And about 40 minutes into the interview, the woman, who at first said she was a reporter gathering information for a story, revealed the real reason she was talking to Bishop. She said that he had raped her in a room in the training center basement in 1984. She was a missionary at the time. The recording is gut-wrenching. In it, she says she wanted to confront Bishop and extract from him an apology and a confession. She was also hoping to get some measure of closure to an incident that had completely changed her life.
What you did to me destroyed my faith and testimony in priesthood leaders and in the church.
Wow.
You took me down. You don't remember taking a sister missionary downstairs into the basement? Okay, let me say this. I need honest time, and, you know, it's a long time ago. 33 years ago is a long time. I need an apology, and I need an admission, and I need to know what was ever done, if anything. Because I have carried this, and it has destroyed my life.
That recording is raising larger questions of what the LDS Church is doing or has done about allegations of abuse by leaders, about whether these mostly lay leaders are trained or equipped to properly deal with these situations, whether they're helping victims or just protecting the reputation of the church. Today in the program, we're also asking, is this an isolated story or evidence of something larger, more systemic? In other words, is this a Me Too movement for Mormons? Joining us first on the program is Lee Hale. He, of course, is KUER's religion reporter. He's been covering the story, and he's with us here in the studio. And Lee, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Doug.
I want to start with the recording. This was leaked by the website, as I mentioned, Mormon Leaks. Just say something about what Mormon Leaks is, first of all.
It's the WikiLeaks for Mormons, basically, right, in that style. The idea is that they are finding documents or recordings that most church members or people interested in the church would never have access to. A lot of what their leaks have been in the past are recordings from Temple Square where general authorities are talking with each other about current events, which are kind of obscure meetings you wouldn't know even happened, mm-hmm. let alone watch them in full. And so this is what they do. They drop these recordings. This one was a little unique. I don't think I've seen one quite like this from Mormon Leaks yet.
We should mention that this was released without the consent of the woman on the recording.
Right. And initially they apologized for that, and then she later said through them that she appreciates it coming to the public.
Now, the reason, I'm not sure why she didn't offer it to them at first, I mean, and this is something we can maybe come back to, but there are apparently some settlement negotiations going on between her attorney and, yeah. and the church itself, and
right.
that may have something to do with it, we think.
Right. The idea is that she was in settlement talks with the church, and this complicated that, yeah. right? It becoming public, because obviously part of settlement talks was that it wouldn't become public.
Yeah.
So I think that in her statement through Mormon Leaks, she said, basically, I was initially upset, but this is accomplishing a greater purpose.
do we have any sense of whether or not the church was trying to, through the negotiations with this woman, keep it from coming out?
Who wouldn't, right? As an organization, right? I think it's the right to assume is that they weren't. This wouldn't have become public. This would have been a quiet issue.
Okay, so let's talk about, I mentioned what happens on the tape. Now, she, how is it that she's getting this interview with Joseph Bishop? She's saying that she's doing, she's a reporter, basically.
Yeah, it seems like he might even be a little confused at the original premise, but it seems like she's just really interested in his life as a church leader, right, as a Mormon church leader, and that it's biographical, the nature of the questions, which he's happy, as any 80-year-old, 85-year-old man would be, to talk about his life in great detail.
Yeah.
And she entertains that idea for about 40 minutes on tape, that they're kind of going through this pleasant conversation about his life, about his callings, and then it takes a turn.
Explain the turn. What happens?
She lets him know that while she was a missionary, he was the Missionary Training Center president, and that he assaulted her.
You know what's remarkable about it is, in some ways, is that he stays in the conversation, that he engages with her. Let me make this clear. That does not excuse anything that happened. But he doesn't admit to, or at least remember, her most serious allegation. We'll talk about that in a moment. But he does stay for nearly 3 hours,
yep,
which is remarkable and interesting. He confesses to her about a lot of things. That part is fascinating.
Yeah, he's very vulnerable in a sense. I don't think he would have been as open if he knew it was being recorded. But
yeah, he did not know that. Well, let's make that clear,
right,
of course.
In talking to his son, Greg Bishop, last week, you know, he talked about how Joseph has recently had undergone he had a heart attack. He went through surgery. I think that his son said basically he's kind of in a vulnerable place in his life right now, nearing possibly the end of his life. And maybe that was the right combination for him to really just talk about these things, really just kind of unload and admit to feel, you know, what he calls an addiction, and admitting to molesting more than one woman. And listening to that is kind of shocking. You're not used to somebody talking that freely about misdeeds and some things that are really dark parts of his past.
I'm wondering what you're assessing the reaction from different people. I'm guessing there are people who are inclined to, I don't know if feel sorry for Joseph Bishop is quite the right word, but seeing, it seems like his son is this way, feeling like this is an elderly gentleman, not completely composed of all his faculties, perhaps having been taken aback, and is revealing things, not knowing he's being recorded, may even be confused. Again, which is not to excuse anything, but let's just explain that. Is there some sense that that might be going on there?
I think that some people I think some people sided with him, but that happens with a lot of assault allegations, right?
Yeah.
Part of what I think upset a lot of people, I noticed online, was that when the church did make a statement, which they did, I think, the day after, on Tuesday last week, they mentioned things about the woman that people felt like were irrelevant, the fact that she was no longer a church member.
Let me read that. I think this is interesting. This is one of our guests later on the program described this statement as a rookie mistake. And it does seem a little tone deaf. It says, "These allegations are very serious and deeply disturbing. If the allegations of sexual assault are true, it would be a tragic betrayal."
Yeah, so big caveat.
Caveat there. That's interesting. But also, the way they describe her is interesting in this statement. Here it is. "The matter was brought to the attention of the church in 2010 when this former church member who served briefly as a missionary." Now, would you just translate what that says? Because I think some people may not see the import of that. But
she came
that
home
seems
early,
packed.
Right?
Yeah.
She came home early. There's a stigma there that she couldn't serve a full honorable mission.
Which might imply what?
Well, it's kind of a cultural death sentence for people, because it seems like they're either not worthy enough or not strong enough to do something that most people are able to accomplish, or at least if they set out to do, they're going to finish. That's another, I think, point that people would say is irrelevant to the fact, you know, whether she was assaulted or not. It doesn't matter. In the recording, she even says part of the reason she came home had to do with the assault, that she was so shocked by that and affected by that she couldn't serve a full mission.
But the statement doesn't say anything about that.
No. I think probably what church PR was feeling was a lot of what Mormons were feeling was disbelief. Mormons don't want to believe that this could happen at the Missionary Training Center, especially. I mean, the amount of power a president of the Missionary Training Center has over these vulnerable missionaries who have just left their families, who are just committing to this huge portion of service.
Thousands of young people.
Right. And a mission president, an MTC president, they're kind of this paternal you know, it's like they're a mix of a parent, of a general authority, of like all these church leaders in one. So I think people just really wanted to believe that somebody who is vetted for that job would never do something like that. And I think that some of that disbelief even comes through in that statement.
Now, to the most serious allegation that she makes, mm-hmm. That he led her into a basement room where he raped her or attempted to rape her. He said that he couldn't get a full erection to the point where he could actually penetrate her, at least completely.
Which I think it's still rape.
Of course. Right. But just interesting, the particulars of the detail. She's quite particular. Now, what is it explain, Lee, if you would, what it is that Bishop admits to or doesn't admit to, because he says in the tape he doesn't remember that particular moment.
It's interesting he says it that way. I don't remember it, right?
Right.
So he's never said, you know, agreed. He's never agreed to the rape allegation. He apologizes to her over and over again, and he says, I must have done something very terrible to you. He doesn't really clarify what that could have been.
Yeah.
A big revelation last week that has kind of been the substance of most people's reporting is a BYU police report made about the same time as this recording, where the BYU police went and interviewed her and Joseph Bishop. And in that, he admits to taking her to this room, a weird room in the basement. You know, it's kind of a strange place.
She says there's a bed and some tapes and stuff like that. He said there wasn't a bed.
Right.
Otherwise, it's a basement room.
It's a basement room where a young missionary should not be, I'm sure.
Alone with
an
older man.
But especially the MTC, there's various missionaries are kind of corralled in these places. So very strange place to be. And he says that in there, he asked her to expose her breast to him.
So he does admit to that.
He does admit to that. So that is the solid... confession. That is kind of the substance of the reporting so far.
What happened in the report? She reported this mm-hmm. to the BYU police.
Right.
What did they do with it?
Well, it's in the '80s.
Yep.
So up to that, I mean, to them, it was past the statute of limitations. There was no action to be taken. I think Mormons see that and think, well, you know, there still is church disciplinary action that can be taken, right? He's still a member in seemingly high standing in the church. But as far as the police are concerned, it's out of their hands.
There's an official report by David Sturgill, Deputy Utah County Attorney.
Right.
When was this?
The report, when it came out?
Yeah.
I think it came out on Wednesday night, or at least news outlets became more of it on Wednesday night.
I want to read part of this because, again, this goes to the question of the statute of limitations. David Sturgill writes in this report, after thorough review and careful consideration, I've determined I cannot pursue criminal charges against Mr. Bishop. I have no reason to doubt the victim's disclosure and would have likely prosecuted Mr. Bishop, but for the expiration of the statute of limitations, the alleged rape occurred in 1984. So legally, that's where that is.
And I will say she has been sharing this story for a long time, she says, since it happened, basically. She says she shared it with a general authority, Carlos Acey, who has since passed away. At the very least, the church in their statement admits to knowing about it in 2010, years ago.
But she said she talked to a general authority much before 2010.
Right. Yeah.
And she said, this seems a crucial part of the story.
That is a crucial part, and that's the big question. The church has said that they don't have a record of that meeting. I don't know how thorough their records are on those kinds of meetings, but if that were true, if a general authority knew about a young missionary being assaulted...
By the MTC president.
Not just by anybody, but by an MTC president. I think it'd be shocking to know that nothing was done.
Now, there's some sense also that AC had given advice and counsel not to seek counseling, but to go to church leaders. And this gets to, I think, a broader point that I want to get to in the show, and we'll get to this later, that church leaders see this as opposed to being this legal matter. They perceive it as this kind of spiritual thing that can be healed or dealt with through prayer and proper leadership counsel.
Right. And it's interesting because I think what she's always wanted is for something to be done about him.
Yeah.
So I think that somebody might agree that when you have some sexual assault in your past, that surely there's some spiritual healing that can take place, but that doesn't change the fact that there wasn't justice, or doesn't change the fact that somebody also might be assaulted by this man. So I think from her perspective that it felt dismissive in the sense where it's like, wait, but there's a guy out there who did this, right?
Yeah.
I will say that the church released some new guidelines yesterday about abuse. And one of those guidelines says that church leaders are not to discourage abuse survivors from going to get extra help, right? Whether that's legal help or help from police, that it's basically up to them to not discourage, which I think is in a lot of accounts happens.
Should be taken seriously. It says most abuse allegations are true and should be taken seriously.
Right.
Now, those that are looking at that the guideline that was released yesterday say that's a good thing. There are some critics of it that say it doesn't go quite far enough. And for example, it does not mandate another person in the room during these one-on-one interviews. It says leaders are, and let me quote it here, the leaders are encouraged to invite a parent or other adult to sit in an adjoining room when meeting with women or children.
It's just kind of a laundry list of some of the stories that we've been covering,
yep,
both you and I, the last few months. What's a bishop's responsibility when somebody comes to them? What's a bishop's responsibility when they're counseling a child about potentially sexually explicit things? So the church is kind of going, you know, one by one and readjusting some guidelines, or at least clarifying some guidelines. I think that this shows that the church is being responsive, maybe more responsive than some people expected.
Yeah.
And I think that that should be pointed out, that it's a good thing that the church is responding. I think the criticism is founded in the sense that maybe it doesn't go far enough. Also, I think people are craving more of a conversation about it. It's one thing to just drop a document, and it's another thing to really have an open conversation about how is abuse happening? Is it still happening? Are there church members right now who have had very similar experiences who need to be encouraged to come out too?
Well, there was no press conference,
right?
No opportunity really to get much beyond the statement, frankly. And I should say we asked the church to possibly offer a representative to join us, and they declined.
And that's business as usual,
of course.
This is something though that this isn't as controversial as other topics the church might not want to speak out about. This is abuse, and especially of a young missionary. It seems like something that most Mormons hopefully can get behind, right? That abuse should not be happening, especially at the hands of an LDS church leader.
Is there a credible case to be made that there were attempts to cover this up?
Well, there is. They weren't. I mean, it's clear that the church was not going to go public with this. And I think that's probably true of any organization of this size. I don't think the church is any different from a major corporation in that sense. There was kind of odd timing with a bill to legislature about one consent recording, or, you know, basically that the Utah legislature was flirting with the idea of not allowing recordings like this to be legal.
And the church was apparently, from reaction by the sponsor of the bill and others, the church was quite encouraging of this.
Right.
And we should say at that time, and it's hard to put the two and two together on this, but the church had been contacted by this woman's lawyer at that time when this bill was being considered at the
right.
legislature. This was in January.
So I think it's fair to say that the church is not interested in recordings like this coming to light. Whether that's a cover-up or whether that's just trying, or that's a denial, I don't know what that is, but that seems like this is not ideal for them.
The statement, the initial statement, and then the release yesterday of the new guidelines. What does this tell us, if anything, about the new administration of President Russell Nelson as the new president of the Mormon Church?
As a reporter, PR has been more responsive since he's been in this new calling. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that, honestly. I think that you can disagree with the church, but at least you want to hear from the church, at the very least. And so I think the fact that they are releasing, they've released three statements in a matter of basically a week since this happened, that to me is a lot more open communication than previous. So I think that my assumption is that President Nelson is kind of allowing the PR department to act and to say some things. It'll be interesting this weekend is General Conference,
right.
His first General Conference as president.
Yes.
Is this going to be a subtle hint at abuse? Is somebody going to go head on and acknowledge that this is happening?
Or if you were to guess, what would you say? Given the inclination, as we've talked about before on this program, their disinclination to quote-unquote apologize, particularly by the now first counselor of the first presidency, Dallin Oaks, who made a rather infamous statement in a conference talk some years ago about not apologizing.
I don't think they're apologizing quite yet about,
yeah.
You know, I don't think that's changed. I would imagine one or two lines about abuse cannot be tolerated. You know, abuse victims are meant to be, believed and understood, but that might be a passing comment in one talk. That's my expectation.
Is this a Mormon Me Too moment? Or is this an isolated incident that people are obviously outraged about and reacting to? Is it too early to say, I suppose?
It's a moment. I think the Me Too moment, what was so shocking and powerful about that was just the sheer number of people sharing their stories. We don't see that quite yet, or at least if people are sharing them, we're not getting the publicity that people during the Me Too moment were getting. So there's still, I mean, there's this brick wall for people when it comes to assault in the church to share their stories, because this isn't just a company you worked for once.
Yeah.
This is your church. This is potentially your path to salvation. And I just imagine the paralyzing fear of sharing a story like this. You know, this woman, the bravery it would take to have the story out there and to go after it doggedly. I mean, that's a painful, painful process that can't be expected of many people to be able to be willing to do that. You know, one thing I will say is it seems a little bit odd is you look at the new guidelines and there's a hotline, an abuse hotline. And you might think that an abuse hotline would be for the people that are abused, but it's for the bishop.
Yeah.
So there's still this bishop barricade. Right? There isn't this easy path for somebody who's potentially been abused by somebody, whether it's in their family or, you know, worse, a church leader. There's just no clear path to say this happened to me and I need help. And I think until that changes, I don't think that we'll hear enough stories.
How important is this to the church to sort of hold the line on the idea that these are issues that can be managed by lay leaders, many of which have no absolute training, you know, absolutely nothing in the way of training?
There's a lot of trust in bishops and local leaders. But they're also, I think Mormons really want to believe that abuse should not happen. I think it's an easy place for people to take a stand. And so I think the question is, what matters more to Mormons, trusting your bishop or protecting people? And I think that a little less trust is needed in order to protect people more.
We're out of time. I want to ask one more to tidy something up here. You've been in contact with the attorney of the woman on the tape. As we said earlier, they've been in contact with the LDS Church. They've been trying to work out some kind of settlement. When the story broke, I guess the negotiations dropped off. If the church doesn't take up the negotiations again, which I'm not sure if you are in a position to say whether they would, if you've asked that question, they are planning a civil lawsuit, I suppose.
Right. They said the door remains closed. The attorney said if the door remains closed, that a lawsuit will be pursued. And I think in her statement, the woman's statement to Mormon Leaks recently, she said when that lawsuit happens, her name will be revealed, that she's going to have more of a public presence in the conversation.
It's Lee Hale, KUER's a religion reporter. Lee, thanks.
Thanks.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about a recording that was leaked last week of a woman confronting the man she said tried to rape her at the LDS Church's Missionary Training Center in 1984. He was the president of the training center, a position of influence and power. She was a missionary. Now, this story, of course, has caught hold. It's raising some larger questions about what the LDS Church is doing or not about allegations of abuse by leaders. Joining us on the program is Angela Clayton. She's a blogger at the LDS blogs By Common Consent and Wheats and Tares. She's an active member of the LDS Church, serves a calling and a reward, is joining us today from a studio in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Angela Clayton, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Lindsay Hansen Park is also with us here in the studio. She's back with us. She's been here before, acting director of Sunstone. It's a progressive foundation that discusses Mormonism. She's also host of her own podcast, Year of Polygamy, writes for the blog Pathios, also a church member, we should say. And Lindsay, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Natasha Helfer Parker is also with us, a certified sex therapist and licensed marriage and family therapist, also president of the Mormon Mental Health Association, host of the Mormon Mental Health Podcast. She's also a member of the LDS Church and is joining us from her home in Wichita, Kansas. And Natasha, welcome to you.
So glad to be with you. Thank you.
Okay, I guess I want to begin broadly. And Lindsay, I'll start with you. The word you used off the air, maybe I shouldn't use that. You said bonkers. I'm guessing you're okay to use that word on the air because this is a crazy story. Give me your general reaction to it.
Yeah, I think that this story is not unique in some ways because the LDS Church has been dealing with these cases. Abuse, of course, isn't exclusive to Mormonism, but it exists certainly in Mormonism. I think the thing that is unique about this case is the level of leadership positions that the abuser held, right? MTC president, he was a mission president. He was also a university president at one point.
Oh, we need to point that out. That's good. President of Weber State.
Yeah, and I believe he was on faculty at BYU at one point, too. I'm not sure what position, but So the access that he had to young women, the access that he had to trust, the years that he served, his credibility is certainly unique. A lot of the Mormon abuse cases that we know of involve usually lay leadership, bishops or church members, ward members. But this is particularly unique because it's someone so high up in the church.
Angela, one of the things that you've written is you ask this question, how do these things happen as often as they do? How are you thinking about this?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, across all of society, 1 in 4 women are victims of sexual abuse. What we find is, at least in my experience, that's consistent with what I see in Mormonism. However, when I talk to other people in the church, so many of them are not aware at all that people that we know have been sexually assaulted or sexually abused. It's definitely on the down low. It's not something people are comfortable talking about at all in society, but much less in the church from what I am hearing.
But so wait, how is it different in Mormonism? It's from that idea that there's not a willingness to talk about it. There's not a willingness to accuse leaders who have these positions apparently supposedly called by God. That's what makes the Mormon part of this distinctive in some way?
That's part of it, yes. And of course, you know, all the same problems that you see in society at large are kind of ratcheted up slightly within the church and probably within every church. There's never such a thing as a perfect victim. There's always something to criticize about the victim or to say there's two sides to every story. But again, that tendency to double down when a leader is in question, I think, is a strong one with any authoritative religion.
Natasha, how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, these issues are very systemic. In the Mormon Church, we have an organization that is very top-down heavy, and that's how the organization is organized. The leaders you know, talk very openly about how they support one another and sustain one another and the importance of obedience and the importance of following your leaders. So it can be very difficult when already, even without that dynamic, it's, as you mentioned earlier in the program, victims have a very difficult time telling their stories, understanding their own stories. It can take years and decades, even in a therapy setting, for a victim or survivor to have a better understanding of what happened to them, to then in this particular system be able to go and self-advocate when oftentimes trauma survivors, that's one of the actual symptoms, is that they don't know how to self-advocate and the system isn't necessarily helping them do that. So one of the things that I thought actually was very problematic about these guidelines that came out yesterday was, you know, when talking to priesthood leaders, it said that they should help those who have committed abuse to repent and cease their abusive behavior. And I see this as one of the reasons why accountability doesn't happen. This is not the role of priesthood leaders. You know, I've been working as a therapist for 23 years. I've been a certified sex therapist for 7 years, and I would not feel qualified to treat a sex offender. Yeah. That's very specific treatment, expertise that needs to be referred out. And these ideas that somehow people can just repent and cease abusive behavior is, quite frankly, just very, it's a very immature statement. It's a very uninformed statement. And I would expect a lot more from an organization that has the resources and energy to really prioritize working on these issues and has said things like they are the best organization doing the best things to deal with these issues, which is quite frankly at this point a flat, bold-faced lie.
And one thing I want to respond to with that, Natasha, is that often the problems with reporting to your bishop and then the bishop going to a hotline is there are cases where the bishops are the perpetrators. So what do you do if you're the victim of your bishop? And this is sort of an ugly thing in Mormonism that we don't like to talk about, but I host a podcast on polygamy. I've heard several stories of bishops grooming congregants for this idea. One happened from a person that went on my podcast to talk about this, but in Wyoming, her bishop groomed her to become a plural wife, and he was eventually excommunicated. But what recourse do you have if your bishop is your abuser? And, you know, I've been blogging about issues in the church for 10 years, and I've heard thousands of stories of abuse, and there are cases where the bishops are the perpetrator.
One of the other things that's kind of insidious and that really makes it difficult for a victim of abuse is that the leaders are privy to the rules. They have Handbook 1. No one else has access to that. No one else is given that, not the female leaders over the women in the church and the young women. And, I mean, honestly, in this day and age, you have to Google these things to find them, but it's not something that that people are given. And many bishops are reluctant to share the information in Handbook 1 with congregants. And if you were a bishop who was abusing someone, you've just been given the handbook on how to kind of navigate the system. It does teach you how to get through that system much better than it would teach your abused victim.
Let's take some
calls. That's an excellent point.
Go ahead. Natasha, did you want to say something else?
Well, just again, in the guidelines, the references to Handbook 1, and when I would link to things that were supposed to help members, it was all going towards a system that I had to enter my membership number, or even then, because I had a priesthood holder who would enter his membership number, he couldn't get in either because he wasn't in a bishopric. So these guidelines are pointing to resources that are not even available to the general membership. So there's no transparency about the policies, about how the church plans to handle these types of situations, and therefore, again, is part of that systemic problem. When I was Relief Society president, I did not have access to the handbook. I sat on ward councils where it was very clear that we needed to support the leaders, especially when there were concerns about complaints, and that we needed to support and sustain those that were in the leadership position. So I'm just echoing everything that the other guests are saying.
It raises a question I want to get you all to talk about, and this is something that Angela's been writing about, is when an abuser is subject to church discipline. And it's interesting to look at the and this is something, Angela, you've done, so I want to hear you on this. If you go through the handbook, the quote-unquote serious transgressions, when discipline, quote-unquote, may be necessary versus when a council must be held. Would you just say something about this? Because these are interesting.
Yeah, the things that are specifically listed as serious transgressions, this was in the church handbook from 2010, which is the one that is publicly available on Google. There is a 2016 version as well. But my understanding is this section hasn't changed. What's changed is what's changed regarding LGBT members who enter a same-sex marriage. But the serious transgressions that are listed as may be necessary for a disciplinary council includes but is not limited to attempted murder, forcible rape, sexual abuse, spouse abuse, intentional serious physical injury of others, adultery, fornication, homosexual relations, especially sexual cohabitation, and again, that's later in the later version updated, and deliberate abandonment of family responsibilities. So again, it's a maybe situation. There are a couple of caveats in the handbook later, one for passage of time, which is, again, written in very broad terms. It says if a member voluntarily confesses a serious transgression that was committed long ago, but there's no actual timeline given, and his faithfulness and service in the intervening years have demonstrated full reformation and repentance, although again, how do we know whether full reformation and repentance is demonstrated? That's left up to the local leader. A disciplinary council often is unnecessary, which sounds like, again, it could be discouraged if a passage of time has occurred, and that is not a defined period of time. And then later it says, time between transgression and confession. If a transgression occurred many years before it was confessed, again, how many years is many? The presiding officer carefully considers intervening circumstances. If the sin was not repeated and the member has lived righteously in the interim, his conduct during the intervening time can show that he has forsaken the sin. In this instance, confession may complete rather than start the process of repentance. But as we know, not all abusers, frankly, are forthright about their sins. It's not like they're all saying, well, on, you know, March 13th in 1984, I invited someone into my second office in the basement of the MTC, and here's what I did. I mean, this is not how these things occur.
I want to get to some of the stories that we're hearing. Let's take a call from Ruth, who's with us in Bountiful, Utah. Ruth, we don't have a lot of time, but welcome.
Okay. When I went to my bishop when I was 15 after approximately 11 years of very severe abuse, thinking he would do something about it, in 1972, he just said, if you know what's good for you, you need to keep this quiet. He told my mother the same thing. He said, if you want your mother to get any child support and you don't want your siblings to starve, you better keep this quiet. Well, my mom didn't take it that seriously because of that. She brought him back into the home. I went out to live by myself on the street because I couldn't get away from him any other way. He went on to remarry and abuse multiple children, but I just felt completely betrayed by the priesthood church authority, like nothing will be done, and it wasn't.
How did it affect your membership in the LDS Church?
I left for quite a while. I still don't believe the priesthood authority when they say they have the power of discernment. Because when I was 8 and I was baptized, they told me, if there are any sins here, don't try to lie about it. We'll know. He stood there, baptized me. I felt like I was baptized by Satan that day. It wasn't a spiritual good experience. It was horrible. I thought they would know. I thought if they had discernment, they would know. It very affected me. And they won't take his name off of my membership as my middle name, as my maiden name, no matter how many times I ask them. So every time I have to look at a temple recommend or any church documents or anything, they refuse to take that name off, which just brings it all up again.
Wow.
You know, I just feel like the males run the whole organization, and us females, we're just pretty much second class. Well, that's pretty much your role, and hush, hush, don't talk about it, you know.
Lindsay, what do you want to react to that? And I do want to also, I'm interested in what effect the woman in this tape had, obviously this made her leave Mormonism. It obviously affected Ruth's sense of faith and her relationship with the church. What are you hearing from people about that?
So yeah, I want to respond to her first, and then I'll answer that question. So I do want to say that Ruth's story is par for the course. This is the story I hear so many times, hundreds of times. In fact, there's a case right now in West Virginia going on with 9 children they're accusing a man in their West Virginia ward of sexually molesting these children over the period of years. They went to the bishop, and the bishop said, forgive him, don't take it to the courts, basically. It was a cover-up. So there's this case going on in court where the parents are suing now the church. And the defense that the church has used in court is you can't fault this man for citing his religious beliefs. And I think that that's really interesting that they're saying that his religious beliefs are valid, which are forgive the man, don't go to the courts about it. And that's an interesting position to take on how the church deals with this. And to speak to what it does, the impact that it has, not only does it traumatize victims, they have to live with the stigma. You know, there are very religious, dogmatic views of sexuality in Mormonism anyway, about purity and being pure and being untouched. So victims have to live with that, but then they lose their faith in the priesthood leaders, like Ruth mentioned, including this victim. And what this does is this stigmatizes victims of abuse, because if you are a member of the church, your power and credibility is in proximity to your faith and to power. So if you're a leader, you have credibility. If you're married to a leader, you have credibility. If you have faith, you have credibility. If you start to lose any distance from any of that, then people won't listen to you anymore. And so the problem with that is if you're being abused, especially by a leader, you speak out against it, you're seen as disloyal. And I would say, unfortunately, in my experience, being in this, you know, studying Mormonism for 10 years and being in this community my entire life, the reaction of most members is to be loyal above all else. So we don't want to throw our leaders under the bus, and we're going to try to protect them over the victims.
Natasha Helfer Parker, I wanted to hear you on what are the effects on people who not only have they been abused when they are, but these people are in leadership positions supposedly called of God. I mean, what does that do to your psyche, your brain?
Yeah, the cognitive dissonance obviously is very high. It's very difficult to sit across the chair with an adolescent who is asking you as their therapist, how was this possible that this person who would do this to me was even called to this position to begin with? There's no good answer to that. I also want to thank Ruth for sharing her story with us. It's very vulnerable for her to do that. You know, there's an interesting study that came out several years ago called the ACE Study, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Impact on Trauma. And we understand more than ever now that, you know, trauma will lead to all kinds of long-term negative consequences for people, including such things as substance dependence, mental health disorders, physical health ailments, sexual dysfunction, impulse control. So again, to Lindsay's point, when these markers are there that, you know, you need to behave a certain way, act a certain way, believe a certain way in order to have credibility, that often falls apart for victims who are struggling to just, you know, lead their lives in ways that they feel that they can survive and be, you know, people in the community who can thrive. So thriving is just a goal, much less all the markers that the LDS Church has. One thing that I will say also that is very insidious to me in all of the comments and all of the positions that the church has come out is that not in one of them is there any level of apology or recognition. Even within any organization, we know that these things are going to happen. Even if you have the best policies in place, even if you have the best types of situations in place, you're still going to not be able to control every single person out there. And yet there's nothing from the church saying, hey, we recognize that this happens. We are so sorry when this happens. We want to help those who this has happened to. And we have these programs in place and these funds in place that any victim who has had any type of issue, we know how to help you. And we take responsibility that these things do happen within our community.
Why?
Well, I think this goes back to the issue of discernment and credibility. And the LDS Church has a concern that if they have to apologize for things, then they have to admit that at times they were wrong. And how can you be wrong if you're the one and only true church that has a direct line to Heavenly Parents? So that is a constant dilemma that we are in because we want to have this assurity and this clarity that we're doing everything correct. But, you know, people are at the helm who are making mistakes all the time. And it's very difficult for us in our culture to accept that leaders in these very important callings could make mistakes, even though we have a historical reference to that with many, many issues from polygamy to blacks in the priesthood to all kinds of things that have changed over the years. But even now I notice that even though those kinds of issues are stated in the essays of the LDS Church, many believing members will have a hard time even reading those essays that are on a website that the church hosts.
Let's take a few more phone calls. Let's go to Lindy, who's waiting in Salt Lake City. Lindy, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I was raised in the church, and after my husband was abusive with me and I went to my bishop, and he said, you just need to be a better wife, I divorced my husband, left the church, and am happy to be out of it. I think that this kind of abuse is so pervasive. It's worse than in the Catholic Church. I know friends who have had horrible sexual abuse and just been, these stories are just so heartbreaking. And it's a patriarchal society, and the end.
Angela, can I get you on to respond to that? To the question of what Lindy is saying, it's as bad as the worst in the Catholic issue, which has been such a rampant issue for the past several decades now. Can you respond to that? Is there something indicative, something systemic within this Mormon part, the cultural part of this, that makes that so?
I'm not sure if I would agree that it's worse than what the Catholic Church went through. I think that they're similar, but I do think that there's a different flavor here, because most of what I hear within Mormonism, it's not because of children being sexually abused by supposedly celibate priests. In our church, it's more about the role of women, and that is very troubling. The advice that's given, or that has been given up to now, to women who are in abusive situations seems very, I'll kind of reuse some of Natasha's words, naive and immature in terms of how we view women and how we understand the dynamics of relationships and human sexuality. We're not very willing to look at the dark side within our community. When you don't even look at those things within yourself, how can you advise people who've really dealt with it? And then the other thing that I think is common between what we just heard from Lindy and from Ruth earlier, who called in, these are some really outdated ideas about women in marriage. And we are led by a gerontocracy. We do have very old leaders. But again, telling a woman, well, if you accuse your husband, you won't get child support, or if you don't stay with your husband, your children won't have a father. That's not good advice. That's terrible advice. But advice based on the idea that a woman can only exist completely financially dependent on her husband, that she does not have any recourse to leave a bad situation. We still have a very high percentage of women in the church who are financially dependent on a spouse, and those are situations that are more difficult for women to leave. To me, that's the Mormon flavor here, is that gender roles are contributing to why women don't feel that they can leave these situations.
Lindsay, yes.
One thing that I want to say is the things that we're discussing today are hard, I think, for a lot of Mormons to hear. I do want to highlight and amplify that I have seen a lot of faithful, active, loyal Mormons who have spoken out about this, who believe the victim. And I'm really proud of them for that. But I will say that I'm sure that there are Mormons listening today that are really uncomfortable. And nothing that I think that we've said today has been, you know, untrue. And I think that that discomfort speaks to something that we need to address in Mormonism, where it's okay that the Mormon church isn't perfect. We don't need it to be. But I think culturally we want it to be. And I think that this idea to be defensive and to hear what we're saying and to dismiss it. You know, I had a family member. I've been a member of the church for 35 years. I had a family member call and say, why do you feel the need to talk about this right now? It happened years ago. And I think it's that exact attitude that contributes and enables abusers in the Mormon church. And if we want to clean this up, we have to get our own house in order. We have a phrase in Mormonism that says, do what is right, let the consequence follow. And I think that that is what we need to do. We need to do the right thing, and that starts by listening to victims and letting there be some accountability and consequences.
And if I could add something to what Lindsay's saying, it is heartening when you see the church come out with a statement like yesterday, where you can tell that they're listening. You know, they're listening, they're hearing people's complaints and experiences. And at the same time, so I'm always a little bit conflicted. Like on the one hand, I want to celebrate that. I want to honor that. I want to say thank you. I want to say that's such a great step in the right direction. For example, when they came out and said that they are now going to allow or even encourage, you know, a two-person system within the church. At the same time, I also hear from the victims and the outcries of how small these steps are, and how triggering it is almost to see the church take such small steps and steps that don't seem to really address the systemic piece of it, the underlying piece of it. And so when I come to the plate with that conflict of wanting to support the church and their changes, but also wanting to support victims and how triggering this can be for many of them, I will always fall on the side of the victims.
Let me take another phone call of Melinda.
One thing I wanted to point out, so my sister and I were both abused by our father, who was also a BYU bishop and a temple worker. So you kind of had that dual situation of not only is it your parent, but you're also seeing your parent, you know, your parent who's supposed to protect and look out for you, but also who's supposed to protect and look out for, you know, congregation members and things like that. So that in and of itself was really a mind trip there. But something that we haven't talked about is the fact that when a woman is abused in any form in the LDS church, and neither my sister and I belong to the church anymore, you're always reporting up to a man. My sister and I were called into the bishop's office and then to the state president, where we were questioned more like we were, like we did something wrong, which did not happen to our father. And at the end of the day, how is that comfortable? How does a woman have to go in and sit with men to discuss very personal, very difficult situations like this to other men? And why have they not done anything to change it?
Let me get Angela. We're running out of time, and I do want to get you to respond a bit to that, but also something that you've been writing about, and that is, you have some kind of action items for women, what they can do if they've been abused and they feel like their complaint is being dismissed. Would you just, we don't have time to go through the whole litany, but could you go through a few of those things?
I think first of all, women need to be aware that what the handbook does say, what it is that leaders are operating from, because the leaders are often local leaders who are responsible for this kind of conversation that they're having with them are often operating from their own mistaken understanding of what the handbook is telling them to do, or they are misinterpreting it or whatever. But maybe they're trying to, sidestep an issue if they feel like they're unsure about the victim. I would love to see victims talk to their female leaders more and ask for advocacy within their wards. I know that that's not always going to be as successful, but again, it's probably a better first step than talking to a male leader who may circle the wagons or identify with the abuser. And I would also say you probably are not going to feel that you'll ever get justice, first of all, for what was done to you, but much less within the church. I would say if you have been abused, you should file with the police. You should take action and regain your power. Again, even if it doesn't come to a satisfactory outcome, at least you are doing what you can do to regain what was taken from you, which is your power and your control.
Quick final thoughts, Lindsay.
And I would just say that most bishops that I know are good men trying to do the best that they can. And so what the church could do by, you know, making a move towards progress is giving them better training. The way that we equip bishops, I think, puts them in a dangerous position as well. These men do not have training. They do not have a lot of education on just comprehensive sexuality themselves. And so right there is one thing that we could do. Our clergy in the Mormon Church don't go to seminary. They're not trained like most pastors are. And that's a problem. And it's a problem for this reason and a lot of other issues.
And Natasha Helfer Parker, I'll give you the final thought here.
Yeah. So when I look at the resources and these new guidelines, they're all LDS centric. And we really need to understand that we are not the experts on these issues. There are many organizations, companies, churches, et cetera, that have built wonderful policies and systems that will prioritize victims. The Department of Health and Human Services itself has a faith community outreach with trauma-informed care. We need to reach out to the experts in the fields that know how to help churches develop the correct policies and stop looking from within when we're very much lacking in what we need to be offering victims and survivors.
It's Natasha Helfer Parker, a sex, marriage, and family therapist, host of the Mormon Mental Health podcast. Natasha, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Lindsay Hansen-Park, Acting Director of Sunstone, host of the podcast Year of Polygamy. Thank you again for coming in.
Thanks for talking about this today.
Angela Clayton, she's an LDS blogger at By Common Consent and Wheats and Tares, joined us from Scottsdale, Arizona. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Technical direction from Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.